Welcome to a bonus episode on Melbourne Fashion Week from the team behind the Critical Fashion Studies podcast.
I'm Harriet Richards, now at the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT.
And I'm Natalia Lusty in the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne. Today we're giving you a snapshot of some of the exciting conversations we attended at this year's Melbourne Fashion Week.
And before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and upon which this episode is being recorded, the Wurundjeri and Boomerang people of the Kulin Nation. We extend our respects to elders past and present, and to any Indigenous listeners tuning in.
Melbourne Fashion Week is always an exciting time in the often crowded Melbourne events calendar. But beyond the glamour and amazing creativity on display in the runway shows and capsule displays dotted around the city, the event also hosted a series of fashion industry conversations. So Harriet, you got up very early to attend the launch of the Australian Fashion Trademark Campaign, as well as the conversation that followed, which was hosted by Creative Victoria and the Australian Fashion Council. So firstly, could you please tell us what the Australian Fashion Trademark is and what it represents for the industry?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Natalia. So it was a very wet and slightly wild morning last week on Thursday when I attended the launch of this new initiative by the Australian Fashion Council, the AFC. And the campaign was funded in part by the Australian federal government and is designed really as a way to sort of foster demand for Australian fashion, both here domestically in Australia and internationally. And it's framed as, it's called an aspirational campaign to capture what's distinctive about Australian fashion. And the idea of a sort of recognisable or identifiable national or regional fashion identity has always been really interesting to me. And indeed, I wrote a whole PhD thesis trying to get to the bottom of what is distinctive about New Zealand fashion. And this initiative is then particularly interesting to me as it aims to sort of distill what might be thought of as quite an ephemeral sense of Australian identity into a brand. What's kind of curious, however, is that this sense of Australianness, if we like, has been attributed to four quite sort of ambiguous characteristics, and those are effortless style, raw nature, boundless optimism, and fearless innovation. So I guess maybe our listeners can sort of think about whether they think those attributes suit their idea of what they think of as Australian fashion. And the CEO of Australian Fashion Council, Leila Najjar-Hibri, has said that she wants us to think of the campaign kind of like a Tourism Australia ad, but for fashion. And I think that really gives us a sense of how the campaign will be promoted internationally and the sort of impact that it might have in shaping sort of future understandings of what Australian fashion means and really looks like for consumers overseas.
Wow, that's fascinating, Harriet. And it sounds very exciting, but I guess also fraught when, you know, any exercise that tries to distill an essence of anything is a fraught exercise. But, you know, I do like boundless optimism, you know, coming out of COVID, I think we need more boundless optimism. But can you also tell us a little bit about what the trademark means for Australian fashion brands?
Sure. And I agree. I think it can be really fraught distilling the essence of anything into one clear thing. So after the launch, which was, you know, just quite a short sort of media launch downstairs at Acme, afterwards we went upstairs and we had a conversation with some of the brands who have been included. And that also included the retail company Vicinity Centres, who's one of the companies behind the campaign, and two of the designers whose brands are included in the campaign. So it was really wonderful to see for me that two of the designers featured in the event at this conversation were Wurundjeri woman Denny Francisco, the designer behind the First Nations brand Nagali, and the young designer Alex Higgins, whose innovative sustainable fashion brand is made entirely in Sydney. And these designers, I think, you know, they're just two of a much larger cohort of designers in the new Australian Fashion Trademark campaign, but they represent, I think, respectively, Indigenous design on one side and sustainable manufacturing on the other, which I think not only are two of the key things that I'm interested in my research, but also two of the sort of key areas that the industry is really fostering at the moment, which have been fundamental to the campaign. And I think that the trademark and the AFC more broadly is kind of hyper aware of consumer consciousness at this precise fashion moment, and they've really designed the campaign to capture that. So for Australian brands like Nagali and Alex Higgins, as well as some of those more established brands in the cohort like Bianca Spender, Dinosaur Designs, or Romance Was Born, the trademark is really an opportunity, I think, to be recognized as part of this larger cohort of brands representing a somewhat, as I said before, ephemeral sense of Australianness. I think it's also interesting to note that not all Australian brands will be branded under this initiative as Australian Fashion TM trademark. Participating brands do have to pay to be registered. So I imagine that for those brands who have signed on to the campaign, they've done the calculations and they've concluded that it will not only be good for their reputation, but also ultimately good for business.
Thanks, Harriet. That's really fascinating and I guess a space to watch for the future, but great to see brands like Nagali represented as part of the trademark. So we both attended the Roadmap to a Circular Fashion Economy conversation. And Harriet, you've done a lot of work on the circular economy in fashion. So could you start by telling us what the National Clothing Product Stewardship Scheme is? That's a bit of a mouthful. And how it aims to make a difference to reducing waste in the Australian fashion industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Clothing Stewardship Scheme is another federally funded initiative spearheaded by the Australian Fashion Council. I must say, and this is a slight diversion from the conversation, but while the fashion industry in Australia has sort of long languished behind other sectors like beer and wine, for instance, as recipients of significant federal funding, it's incredibly exciting to see the impact of these large investments on things like the National Clothing Stewardship Scheme and on the Australian Fashion Trademark. So a real groundswell of support for the Australian fashion industry, which I think for you and I is incredibly inspiring and encouraging to see. But anyway, the scheme. So this is a project designed in consultation with a number of different stakeholders across the industry and in academia as well, with the aim of better dealing with clothing waste. So in the recent clothing data report, which has been quite widely publicized, so our listeners may have heard of it already, and this was released as part of a package of research supporting the scheme, and it was brought out by the Australian Fashion Council just a month or two ago. It was reported that Australia imports over 373,000 tons of new clothing per year. So that's a lot, but it's also quite a hard number to quantify. So to put that in slightly more recognisable terms, that's about 15 kilos or 56 new clothing items imported into this country per person per year. So an astounding statistic, and unsurprisingly, you know, it gets a lot of media attention. And despite the incredible upswing in vintage and secondhand retail that we've seen in recent years, the issue of what to do with all of these clothes once they're no longer in use is, of course, an enormous challenge. So the scheme not only advocates for circular thinking across the design and manufacturing phases of garment production, but it also plans to introduce tariffs on clothing imports and to improve consumer education on what to do with garments when they come to the end of their life, or indeed the end of their life in your closet. So what you're going to do with them next. So learning more about this scheme, it's always really exciting to hear what can be achieved when a group of different players from across the industry come together for a common goal. And so I want to pass the microphone on to you, Natalia, to perhaps tell us a little bit about who was speaking on the panel and the different perspectives that they brought to the conversation.
Sure, Harriet. Speaking of fashion and textile waste, we heard from Belinda Paul, who has started a direct-to-consumer textile recycling service simply called Recycle, so R-C-Y-C-L. So this is one of those very simple but effective schemes whereby you log on to the website and ask them to send you a bag, which is free. You then fill your bag with your old clothes, so clothes that are no longer suitable for charity bins or secondhand stores. You then drop the bag, the full bag, at one of the many designated locations, and your items are recycled into new yarn instead of ending up in landfill. And as we heard from the clothing data report, which you mentioned earlier, Harriet, there is still very little recycling of clothes and textiles in Australia. So this is addressing citizen behaviour by making it easier to not put your clothes, your old clothes, in the bin. Next, we heard from Alicia McCallan, who is a sustainable textile expert from the Monash Sustainable Development Institute and one of the co-authors of the Textiles, a Transitions Report for Australia, which was released in the lead up to Melbourne Fashion Week. Alicia spoke about the important research she and her colleagues have been doing on some of the barriers for industry in designing and making for a circular economy. And some of those barriers include the education of citizens about how clothes are made and the costs associated with making sustainably and designing and making for a circular economy, but also the complexity for industry in terms of staying abreast of the latest technology and innovations in sustainable production, as well as designing for longevity. And we also heard from Dewey Cook, who is the CEO of the Social Studio in Collingwood. And this is an enterprise that you and I have both been following closely. So it was great to hear more detail about what they do. So the Social Studio is a not-for-profit social enterprise that runs a fashion school for refugee and new migrant workers. And this is a wonderful initiative that combines an education program, a production studio, and an in-house label. It's an enterprise committed to ethical and sustainable modes of production, everything from using upcycled fabric and textile waste that would otherwise go to landfill, to empowering young people to design and make distinctive, well-made, trans-seasonal garments that hopefully will remain in our wardrobes for years to come. And finally, we heard from Paula Rogers, who is the General Manager of Sustainability at DeCuba, which is a large fashion label with now over, I think, 140 retail spaces across Australia and New Zealand. So really quite a large label by Australian standards. And interestingly, Paula was asked whether we would ever see a fashion business model that advocated making less and selling less, so basically a degrowth model. And I thought, Harriet, she really cleverly deflected that question by emphasizing instead the importance of business models that decouple economic growth from resource consumption. In other words, doing more with less. So she stressed the importance of design principles that eliminate waste and pollution in supply chains, both upstream and downstream, and also the importance of regenerative textile products, so either animal or plant-based textiles that draw down carbon and enhance biodiversity. And it's interesting that a term that I've just become familiar with more recently is this idea of farm-to-closet fashion. So this is an idea that increases accountability and traceability for the consumer. So it will be interesting to see whether that term takes off. And she also gave a plug for rental schemes for fashion brands and retailers as one example of a business model that is doing more with less. And we've seen, you know, rental schemes really take off across the fashion sector. So I think that's also potentially exciting. So all up, very different perspectives, very different challenges, and of course, different business models and scales.
Yeah, fantastic. I think that idea of farm to closet, you know, we've seen that in the restaurant space for a long time, farm to table. So it's interesting to see it trickling down to other aspects of our lives. And also the idea of doing more with less, which when we're thinking about, you know, business as usual, it's curious to see the ways that different business models are trying to shift the perspective from that business as usual to new models. So the final conversation that we attended was the Make It Melbourne panel with representatives again from across the Melbourne fashion landscape, including Margie Woods, who's the creative director and founder of Victoria and Woods, who manufactures almost entirely in Australia. Julia van der Sommen, who is the director of The Sample Room, again, a business based in Collingwood. Vicky Nicola, who's a lead educator of fashion and millinery at Kangan Institute. And Kate Dillon, who's the creative director and founder of She Lion, which has done amazing work with local producers as well. So Natalia, why do you think that this panel in particular really created a buzz?
Oh, absolutely, Harriet. I think we both love this panel for various reasons. But firstly, you know, we started, even before the conversation began, we started with those incredibly moving screenings, which really gave us a very vibrant account of the history of Melbourne's, you know, once really buzzing fashion manufacturing and making scene, built largely by migrant workers in the pre- and post-war period, with textile mills and fashion manufacturers dotted around suburbs such as Collingwood, Abbotsford, and Richmond. And we also saw some wonderful photographs of Flinders Lane in the city, which in the 1950s and 60s was also a very vibrant hub of fashion manufacturing. But of course, the industry suffered and went into decline as manufacturing increasingly moved offshore. But I think on the back of COVID and the disruption to supply chains, also, you know, the difficulties in trading with China, which, you know, does a huge amount of fashion manufacturing, and also the emerging desire to control textile quality and improve production values, there's this new buzz for onshore fashion manufacturing emerging. And Melbourne, I think, is poised once again to become the fashion capital of Australia. So it's really exciting to see the increasing demand and emerging pride, actually, in Melbourne-made fashion products. And one of the most moving accounts in those screenings was hearing from, you know, our own Melbourne's Lord Mayor, Sally Capp, who was actually the granddaughter of a milliner from Flinders Lane. So she has this wonderful connection to the history of Melbourne manufacturing and, you know, a real desire to see it flourish again. And she said, and I quote her here, "The fashion industry was big business for Melbourne and the manufacturing was an important part of the whole process." And she says, "It's a cycle of connection from the creativity of a designer through to the making, through to the showcasing of a runway, through to the retail experience." So I guess, you know, when you've got someone like Sally Capp really gunning for the industry with such passion, then I think there's real hope for Australian manufacturing more broadly, but, you know, making in Melbourne specifically. So I've talked about some of the optimism in the room, which we both felt. But there's also some very real challenges to making in Melbourne and for onshore manufacturing. So, Harriet, can you please tell us a bit about what those challenges are?
Yeah, sure. And I think it's really interesting you draw on Sally Capp because she was there at the launch of the Australian Fashion Trademark first thing in the morning. She introduced Layla from the AFC. And so I think her commitment to the fashion industry and that personal history that she has with the industry is incredibly important for fostering this new optimism, if we keep using that word, optimism and hope in the Australian landscape, but also specifically in Melbourne, which was certainly, as you said, we felt it in the room as we were there. But you're absolutely right. There's some massive challenges too. And I think it was particularly interesting to hear from designers and makers from brands of different scales. So Victoria and Woods, Margie Woods was talking about, you know, she's a medium-sized business. She has quite a lot of retail stores and she's using a lot of the manufacturing capabilities in Australia. And then on the other end of that, you know, was Kate Dillon, who was producing at a very, very small scale, but trying to do the entire production process right here in Melbourne. So very different scales. And then, of course, the education piece as well at Kangan Institute. So I think that really demonstrated the scope of those challenges across the whole supply chain. But I think for me, the key challenge that struck me, and this was brought up by panelists across the conversation, was that we lack skilled machinists and technicians in Australia. So as you said, you know, we've witnessed this offshoring of production, which has really sort of gutted the industry. So there is this ever-increasing demand for Australian-made, and the return to onshore production since the pandemic, as you say, has really been well-documented, and we're seeing that just increasing every year. However, garment production in this country really tends to be an aging workforce, and the new generation of graduates, including my students, really tend to be more interested in fashion marketing or fashion design than they are in the making or the manufacturing. So this is an issue across the sector and is really exacerbated by these kind of reputational factors as well as educational opportunities and pay rates. But as you said, and as Sally Kapp mentioned, you know, fashion is a process that includes many hands across the entire supply chain, from the manufacturer, the design, right through to those runway shows. So we need a multitude of skills and people. And I think it's about fostering and supporting and celebrating all of those people, not just, you know, the key designers, for instance. So at the end of the conversation, which was quite a beautiful way to end, we heard from a student in the audience who said quite rightly that she could earn more working in retail than as a machinist. And then there's the reputational factors, of course, that go along with that, other aspects that she kind of perceived about the industry. So I think if we really want to support the local industry and regenerate the garment industry in this country and this city, perhaps what we need to be doing is an investment in that generation, that younger generation who's coming through, and celebrating not just those fashion designers, and I think Julie actually said this on the panel, but also celebrating those incredibly talented makers and manufacturers, the craftspeople whose hands are actually making our clothes.
Yes, absolutely, Harriet. And I think Julie van den Somnen put it really well by saying we need to make manufacturing and making sexy. And, you know, I think she talked about the atelier model as one way in which to bring everyone together and having a workplace that values the makers as much as the designers. It was interesting to hear from Kate Dillon, you know, in her endeavor to make a Melbourne-made fleece sweatshirt. And she said in making that one garment, it touched from zero to wear, it touched 300 highly skilled hands. So that gives you a sense of just how gifted and how, you know, kind of skilled the sector is in terms of, you know, what it does in manufacturing when you break it down into those smaller components. And so I think, you know, you also touched upon the issue of wages and, you know, the fashion industry is critical, you know, as we know, to the economic security of Australian women, given that women make up 77% of those employed in the industry. So it would be really wonderful to see some government scaffolding here in terms of supporting this industry and working towards fairer and, you know, longevity in terms of wages.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, that 300 hands, that's incredible. We've got the capacity, but on such a small scale. So it's just, I guess, about fostering the growth of that.
Thanks, Harriet, and thanks to everyone for listening. That's all we have time for today. Of course, we could talk about these issues for forever, but just stay tuned for more Critical Fashion Studies podcasts in the future.
Thanks, Natalia. For now, let us just thank Thomas Phillips for excellent sound design and editing behind the scenes, Hugh Caldwell-Ross for our beautiful logo, and the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne for their ongoing support for the work of the Critical Fashion Studies Research Group. See you next time.
Bye.